I know, are over it, mm-hmm. and in your turn, and you can follow that thing. Yeah. You're looking straight out your side window. You can open the side window. You can't open the front window, you see, yeah. the blast's too great. Yeah. But you can open the side. Well, we found that, and I used it a great deal myself, very, very effective, because it was either dense smog around that city of Brussels, or it was raining yeah. Yeah. at that time of the year, and it yeah. poured rain. Well, also, I'd been in and out of the air so much at that point that if I could just see the odd familiar sight, like the mm-hmm. steeple of a church or something like that, I knew where mm-hmm. it was. Or, mm-hmm. So, I remember one day I had a visit from Group Captain Hendrick of our Canadian Air Force, and he was one of our top signalers. He knew all these radar and radio devices and aids for navigation and so on. And he wasn't familiar with our type of operation, nor was he familiar with operations in general. He can come over from Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps purposely I didn't tell Max about this aid. I took him up for a flight, and he was a little bit out of flying practice anyway at that stage. And so he was sitting in the co-pilot seat beside me, and it was one of those miserable days where you could see damned all. And I flew him around the countryside a bit, came back to the airfield, and managed to fly over the field. And of course, once I flew over the field and had my side window open, I had a pretty good chance of seeing the what I call the farmer's aid. And I picked this up and put myself into a downwind leg, and then did the curve, the 180 degree turn from the downwind leg onto the landing leg, came around, and all this time he hadn't seen a damn thing out of his front window. He just couldn't see anything, and I think he was probably a little shaken, you know. And all of a sudden we leveled out. As soon as I saw that straight yeah. curve end and the straight portion start, then it was time to level out. I put her in the final landing configuration and touched down. And when we did, he turned to me and he said, "For Christ's sake, what have you done in the last few years? Have you developed radar eyes or something?" He just couldn't get over it because he hadn't seen a thing yeah. until I finally yeah. leveled that thing out in a few 100 feet above the ground. Yeah. Right now. Well, a short time after that, I had a visit. Had a lot of visitors in Australia. I had a visit from the chief of staff of the Iranian Air Force, Persia, I guess we called it in those days, General Natsdevan. And I thought, well, I better explain to this fellow. It was a miserable day, but he wanted to have a flight in the Mitchell. Yeah. He wanted to see something of these operational aircraft that we were. So I took him up. This time I thought, no, I better not frighten this fellow. I explained as best I could, but there was a language barrier. I don't think the interpreter got things too straight. I tried to explain to him that the viz was poor and not to be too frightened to him, that I'd get him down because we had an elementary aid that the Germans had left, and it was just I could just follow a line on the ground. And I think that he felt that I was trying to hoodwink him and keep him from getting wind of some of our secret devices. Anyway, I took him up there, and again, it was pouring pitchforks when we came back to land. And I went through this routine, and finally got down and landed. And when we got out of the aircraft, he said, "I have never seen anything like that." He said that was absolutely remarkable. And then he started questioning me, all sorts of questions on how it was done. And obviously, he felt that I had something there in the yeah. way of a special, modern, highly yeah. technical development that I was using, and I wasn't letting him know about it. And he would. I don't think to this day that fellow would believe that yeah. he was brought in by this simple yeah. device.
I was plowing a field.
Yeah. yeah. Well, because of the prevailing weather conditions at that time of the year, it was rather important to have some sort of assistance for getting down. And by that time, and of course a year or so, I guess, before that time, the RAF had perfected this device that you've heard referred to as FIDO.
Yeah.
Now, FIDO was a fog. F stood for fog, D for device, and I've forgotten what I stood for, but at any rate, it was a fog dispersal operation that mm-hmm. Took place.
How did that work, though, Larry?
Churchill really pushed it for this one. He, mm-hmm. We were having such heavy losses in Bomber Command, yes, through aircraft coming back and and crash landing because the fog had moved in and they couldn't land at their bases and the aircraft were landing. People were bailing out and empty aircraft were coming down all over the place. And so this was a fairly elementary, simple device. There was piping put down adjacent to the runways, both sides of the runway. And then the pipe carried gasoline. The gasoline was pressurized, and there were little devices that, which would, on demand, release that gasoline through jets and ignite it.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have an igniting device and so on. And it generated, it used a hell of a lot of petrol. I think it was against it. But it generated enough heat to change the condition of the atmosphere and disperse the fog. Now, it meant that you were landing in a fiery mass, and it meant that if the operation wasn't carefully conducted, if you sort of didn't have the proper ignition, the flame wasn't burning quite right, you'd generate a lot of carbon and in the air, smoke and carbon, and that's all you need to restart the fog again, because fog, water vapor forms on things like that and makes fog. So there was a period when it required a great deal of experimental work to get it right, but they did get it right, and it was terribly beneficial. It really was beneficial in helping bomber crews get down on bad nights. And indeed, the RAF reckoned that they saved about 2,400 aircraft with this FIDO equipment.
That I won't imagine.
But it had to be. It had to be properly installed, very carefully installed, and had to be very carefully prepared for operations. Crews had to be well trained, and it had to be properly ignited and burnt. And that was, you could do that on an established airfield or one of these big emergency fields they had for recovering damaged aircraft in England. But in the field, it wasn't so easy. A field installation, field installations are sort of really haywire compared with these permanent installations at home bases. There weren't many in the field in Europe, but my boss, Basil Embry, had been a great promoter of FIDO in the early days. That was the sort of thing he really went after, holus bolus. And so when we went to Brussels and he saw what the weather was like there, his headquarters were by this time in Brussels, he was all for getting FIDO over there. So we got one of those field installations. And my crew had never operated this stuff before, and field installation was nothing nearly as good and effective as the permanent installation. And it didn't work out too well. But one day, he was coming in to land on it. It was a murky day rather than a foggy day, although he seemed to feel it was fog and murk. And he made a couple of passes with his Mosquito, and he couldn't line up in the runway. The visibility was just so limited that by the time the Mosquito came in fairly fast, by the time he got down in the relatively the right position, he would be and was able to see the ground. Instead of being down the center line of the runway, he might be off to one side of the runway and too far to get corrected over and get on, so he'd have to overshoot. I think he made about 3 overshoots, and he called up the control tower and said, "Put on the FIDO." So we got the thing on rough as they could, but it takes a little while to organize to get it on. I think I already had the chaps in a pretty high state of training, but nonetheless, it took them time to get out there into their positions. By this time, he was getting a little low on fuel, and he was getting a little impatient.
Yeah.
I was in the control tower. I could hear him getting a little annoyed that we were taking so long to get it started. And then we got it started up. He came in, and of course, really, it made the biz worse, because it wasn't really fog. You can't disperse smog with that sort of thing. You can disperse it. So he made another pass, and it was a flop. And he made another pass, and it was a flop. And by this time, he was getting a little panicky. And he had a pretty strident voice, and I heard that he said, "Turn that goddamn FIDO off and leave it off." So he went around the next time. He just happened to get lined up and came in. We didn't hear very much more about Fido from
wow.
Basil Embry after that.
Wow.
And I don't think it was ever used again on that field after that. We really didn't need it. We were better off with the thing the Germans had left us than we were with this particular aid under those particular conditions.
Yeah. What about your bombs, especially at this time? Now, you'd be using tons and tons of bombs, presumably.
Yeah.
They would have to come by ship over to one of the French
ports. That is right, and there weren't too many ports available at that
stage. I know. And then they'd be up by truck or by
train. That's right, you see, Antwerp wasn't put back into service too rapidly.
No, that's right.
And people were banking an awful lot on Antwerp.
Yeah.
A lot of bombs came up by lorry all the way from Normandy.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, they had scheduled down there, you see,
and
a lot of them came up from there.
There's one other thing I was going to ask you about that field. Would you have at that field any elements of the RAF regiment?
Yes.
You did?
Yes, we did, yeah. Yeah, we had RAF regiment on the field.
Yeah. They would be under your command, or?
Yeah.
Or?
Operationally they were under my command, but administratively I guess they came under the...
The
colonel who was attached to two group.
Yeah.
Colin Campbell. Wore a kilt.
Is that right?
Yeah. He and this group, Captain McDonald, I referred to on our last session, were always at loggerheads with one another, the Campbells and McDonalds. I've dropped quite a lot on this, but...
We'll have to...
Let's see what we'll wind up with. Operations in October, November, and December period were not terribly satisfactory. The weather was just too uncertain for our type of operation. To get up there and get formed up in the smog, and get off to a target and find that it was either half covered in poor vis or cloud. It was somewhat unsatisfactory, and although we offered it fairly frequently, there were long periods when sometimes days would pass and we weren't able to operate. The weather wasn't good enough in Ellsworth, wasn't good enough out there at the target area. So from an operational point of view, we weren't anything like the wing that we had been in England. We were in England operating often twice a day, day after day, and certainly once a day for the longer fights. In Melsbrook, we were only getting in maybe a couple of decent operations a week.
What about the reverse, Larry? What it would be known by the Germans that you and other squadrons had that field. Did you get any bombing?
Yeah, well, now that was one of the things I was going to talk about. I was going to mention the effect of the Battle of Bulge on us, but I'll skip that since we haven't got much time. On January the 1st of 1945, the Germans saved up everything they had by way of fuel and aircraft and so on to make their great Sunday punch. And boy, they really collected a lot of aircraft together. It was a big raid. And that was the first time. We'd been there since end of September. We moved in there in the 10th of October, but I've been going in and out of there since the latter part of September. That was the first raid on Melsbrook in that period of time. But they put over 1,000 aircraft in the air that day. And they attacked our major installations. They went after airfields mainly.
Yeah.
And 36 aircraft came against Melsbrook. And the hunting was awfully good there. There were aircraft every place. I couldn't estimate for you how many forts and nibs there were on that field, but I would say there weren't less than 100 scattered all over the place.
Yeah.
And the fort and the lib are big enough to stand out, so they were pretty good aiming points for people suddenly attacking the field. And then the density of parking of other aircraft is high. But fortunately, I felt a gross like the mischief about this because... naturally, I've been a little bit of partying on New Year's Eve. We had a warning for operations before midnight, and they had to get off the bed, and they were called out about 5 a.m. for a... It takes quite a while to get chaps up and prepared and ready in the aircraft, and ready to listen to crews briefed and so on. They were called for a 9 o'clock takeoff, and that meant getting up around 5 or 5.30. Well, there were some pretty browned-off boys about this. But we were off, and airborne at 9, and the Germans struck at 9.15.
Oh, boy.
So, and it was a pretty full all-out effort on my part. I had to get up as many aircraft off as I could.
Mm-hmm.
It was just fortuitous. Here we were off 15 minutes ahead of them.
Yeah.
In other words, if they'd come a half an hour earlier, they would have cut these things.
Yeah.
Concentration. Yeah. Oh. So, again, there's a lot of luck in this business. when they came back from the raid, they just couldn't understand what had happened. There were aircraft burning all over the field. They'd set an awful lot of those forts and bibs on fire.
Oh, yeah.
So they were still burning. So when 2 hours later, when my brothers came back from that raid, there were fires all over the place and smoke and all that. But although they were the Germans did quite a lot of damage, it really ruined them from that. They lost a lot of aircraft, too.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the Spitz and other fighter aircraft got into the air in time to whack away at them. And they couldn't stand the losses. We could take the losses. They couldn't stand them. So I think in the long run, they lost out on that deal. They lost. They used an awful lot of their... And they had very limited fuel at that time.
But weren't they... Weren't they flying jets, some of the jets, by this time?
Yes, they... Yeah, but they didn't have too many, and that wouldn't be the type of aircraft they'd use on the...
No, I just didn't know the sense of what they had.
Well, just to finish off, I mentioned that our operational activity was not as intense as it had been, and for that reason, I suppose, we got more visitors. Maybe group headquarters thought they'd better keep the boys on their toes some way. This is a very popular visit from Lord Trenchard, the father of the RAF. He was by this time nearly 80. But boy, he was a striking-looking figure, and he was a very tall man, you know, and he had that booming voice. He was called Boom Trenchard. And he came, and, you know, he had learned to fly in World War I when he was way beyond the age that anyone should have learned. He was serving in India on the Northwest Frontier in 1885, and he was a major by the time the Boer War started. And then he... And he was so severely wounded in the Boer War, you know, he got hit right in the chest, and he was given up for dead. And but he was invalided out, and he went as a political officer in one of those West African nations, and his military career was over, people thought. But he came back to England just before 1914, I guess he came back by 12 or 13 when they were forming the RFC.
Yeah.
And he decided that was for him. He must have been well up in his 30s when he learned to fly. Wow. Well, this sort of thing, he gave a wonderful talk to both boys. And, very inspiring. We were just about to have an operational briefing. I think he attended the briefing, but he talked to us before that. Then the next day we had a visit from Tedder, and, you know, few days later from Harold Balfour, who was the Undersecretary of State for Air, so we had some interesting visitors.
Yes.
Of course, over in Dunsfold, I didn't mention it, we had, because of the Dutch squadron there, as a result of the Dutch squadron being there, the Queen Wilhelmina had come and visited the wing, and later Princess Juliana had come, and so on. And there were some interesting contacts from time to time. Well, I think we'd better wind things up at this point, and... next week I'll... this will end it. My time was nearing an end with 139 Wing, because there had been several efforts made, as I think I mentioned once before, to promote me. My contemporaries were getting ahead of me, and I refused to leave the wing earlier when they wanted to promote me. Because I didn't... Who'd want to leave a job like that just before D-Day?
Yeah.
So, finally, in January, I received notice that I was to proceed back to Bomber Command to take over a post in the rank of Air Commodore, and that I would be going to Middleton St. George, which was up in southern part of Durham. It was the most northerly base in the 6th Group. 6th Group
Yeah.
Whereas stations were all up to Vale of York. And my post up there was to be the chief of what they call a clutch of stations. Now, that clutch term didn't really stick, but that's what the term they used at that time. And I knew, and a clutch had generally two or three stations, with each of which would have two or more squadrons, those big, heavy squadrons. Mm-hmm. Well, that Middleton St. George, the main station was Middleton St. George, and the subsidiary station was Crockett. There were just the two big stations. Ultimately, they referred to it instead of a clutch as a base, and a base had two or more stations.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, that's a confusing thing, because we use the term base to, and I've been using it here, to refer to what sometimes is called a station.
Yeah.
So there's confusion of terms. But I got up, the date of my handing over from of 139 Wing was the 22nd of January. I handed over to the Royal Air Force a lad by the name of Colbert Welch, Group Captain Colbert Welch. So, that very day I flew back to Inner Mitchell and to the UK, and I'll perhaps tell you something about that later.
When was this, how shall I put it? You were promoted, but who was promoting you? Is it the RCAF or RAF?
No, it would be the RCAF. You see, the RCAF were endeavoring to get me into a job which was an air commodore's job. And they were the ones who threatened to take me away. The RAF would have been upset about the change of command just before D-Day.
Yeah, yeah.
Naturally.
Yeah.
And just as I was. So it was my headquarters in London, the RCAF headquarters in London, who were looking after my interests.
Ah, I see.
And they had tried to, 6 months before D-Day, they were going to post me into another job, or I guess 4 months before. And then almost at D-Day, they had come up with another post they wanted me to fill. So I was able to postpone it till after. And by the time it finally came, it was time for me to leave. The activity in the wing was, because of the weather, was winding down, and I was happy to get on to something different at that time.
Well, how many Canadians of a rank senior than Air Commodore would be in
the UK at that time?
In the UK at the time, yeah.
Not many. Not many. You see, there were several other clutches or bases in Sixth Group, the Canadian Bomber Group.
Yeah.
And that meant there was an air commodore in each of those.
Yeah.
There were, I guess, four such bases, or five. So there were, including myself, there would have been five in Sixth Group. And then at Sixth Group headquarters, there was one air commodore. And on the staff at Bomber Command by that time, there was one air commodore. So there were six air commodores on the operational side. And I suppose there might have been one or two or three, I don't know, at RCAF headquarters in London.
Mm-hmm.
There were several there. Wolf Curtis had been filling one of those positions. I don't know whether there was... maybe there was only the one there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But... No. There was more than one there. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be equivalent, what, to a brigadier?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, there you are.
Well, lovely, sir.
Good.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now, I'll, before we lay one on, Larry, for next week,